She's a former Detroit Free Press environment reporter and SEJ's second board president after founding president Jim Dechen, who, by the way, is in China this year, missing his first SEJ conference ever. Amelia is now a freelancer and a teacher and, would you believe it, a game developer at the University of Michigan. Here's Amelia to introduce her panel.
Thank you very much, Pam. We have a wonderful morning planned for you, or hour or so this morning planned for you, that's full of fun and full of games. But before we go there, we have a very special demonstration to kick us off. Another familiar SEJ face, Bill Allen, now of the University of Missouri, is here with a surprise.
Just so you can see what it's like and hear what it's like, I want to introduce Cade Cleveland, C-A-D-E, who's a senior in our science and ag journalism program at the University of Missouri, and he's eminently hireable. So what we're going to do is just mess around for 10, 15 minutes, fly a little. I'll show you a video product that the students in a drone journalism class we had this past spring did. And then we'll fly a little more. And if you want to ask Cade questions about this device and what it's like to fly it, that'd be cool, too, if we have time. And this is a DJI, I can't remember, I or Y, Phantom. This is the exact same drone that crashed on Manhattan Island and almost hit a stockbroker earlier this week. Cade was not flying. We were here. We have witnesses. Anyway, we'll talk more about how we used it in a little bit, but take it away, Cade. We won't hurt anybody, we promise. We won't fly very close to you. That would not be wise. This thing weighs only a couple pounds, but who wants a couple of pounds of drone in their coffee? You can see the video. There is a small camera called a GoPro camera. Cost about $400. It's attached to the front of the drone. You can tell the front by the red lights, the two red legs. The green is behind, and how's that video? That's looking good. Well, we got a little interference in here with the signal, but you get the idea. Let's see. I was going to ask Kate if you felt like flying over that Toyota, but there are some air intakes just above it, which would not be good to fly near. You find out real quickly that the air current down where we're standing is different, when you're outside at least, than the one 10 feet above and 20 and 30. So these young people who learn to fly, the best ones are ones who have played a lot of video games, it turns out. All right. What I'm going to do now is play a story that the students produced, one of the more interesting ones, and we'll go for something next, time permitting.
Dennis? Great.
Are we set, Dennis? All right, good. I'll let the story speak for itself.
We know prairie is only maintained if you get periodic fires. If you don't burn, then it'll turn into forest. A lot lot of this is native. I mean, this has never been plowed, which is critical. The minute you plow it, you lose hundreds of species. If you let woody species come in, it's no longer a prairie. This is a native grassland, produces a lot of seed. Some of these big blue-stem grasses are probably 1,000 years old. When they put the interstate in, we lost a few acres to the interstate. We've got to keep it under control. And even though this year we don't have much fuel, you can feel how hot that fire is. Because once you start it, it's really hard to put it out. If you put in good fire lanes, you have the right crew. Hope the wind holds. We've had runaway fires a couple of times. The wind shifted on us. You want to get rid of woody growth because woody growth will take over. But if you burn it too often, then you favor the warm season grasses. In a wet year, the grasses will be up to here and the seed heads will be up over my head. I have about 300 species of plants here. There isn't a whole lot of replacement by seed because these plants can live forever and ever. They're adapted to fire.
Thank you. Thanks. You can see that a story that adds, a drone that adds value to a story can be pretty cool. We learned a lot. You know, this was early in the semester when the pilots were still getting the feel for things. And right now I'm trying to get another video, but I may not get it because of the slowness here. Try one more thing. Just to, from the point of view of a student experience, which is a journalist experience in this way, gives you an idea from his perspective. He was the pilot. His name was Brendan Gibbons.
When Bill invited me to do this class, the first real use I thought of was flying over forest fires. It was kind of a proof that you could fly over a fire and it wouldn't destroy the equipment. About is hot air rising really fast, and you can even just see it, the shimmering air above the flames. There was one shot that I did that I flew really low over some flames and then tried to keep it low, but I just couldn't because the air was rising so fast, and within a few seconds I was hundreds of feet in the air. The more you fly it, the more you're able to put your imagination into the cockpit, and you have to because you have to steer as if you're in the cockpit just with your right hand. I think of the drone as sort of a macroscope, and so you don't really see individuals, you see our collective actions on the landscape. I think that's why this tool is really useful, because once you're up above that high, you can see how much human actions have changed everything.
Okay, good. That was produced by some other journalism students who are hanging out with our students, and was the point there. The idea that Brendan had of seeing a landscape, I thought that was pretty cool. I'm forgetting other things, but why don't we move on to, if we can have two more minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have low battery,
9 minutes. Okay. Well, what we'll do is... Yeah, you go for it. We have one more demonstration to do for you, and if there are a couple minutes afterward, Cade may be able to take questions. But let's go ahead and present the first moon pie ever delivered by a drone in the history of the world to a special person we all know and love, even though he's a little angry with us sometimes. We love him dearly. They're finicky little machines sometimes. You have to turn on certain things at first, and then second, and then third. The one thing I'll warn you, I mean, you can go to Amazon right now, order one of these, and be flying it tomorrow. It's not that easy to learn to fly. Let's see what happens. Jay, would you mind stepping up? The Dancing Moon Pie is award is presented to Jay Leto. Valued. He really wants it. Thank you. Nice job, Cade. SEJ's pushing those moon pies, so help him out.
All right. We're done.
You want to take over?
Do you want to take one question now?
Okay. Any questions for our pilot or anyone else who might be standing here? Yeah. I personally like it more, even though I haven't flown it more than a few feet off the ground. What do you think, Kate?
So there are a lot of different quadcopters out there as of yet. This one can be purchased by anyone off of Amazon for about $600. And there are some that will cost you a couple tens of thousands of dollars. And it's hard to say before you buy one which model is going to be really reliable. This one has a good reputation for being reliable and cost-effective. And if you have a little bit more hardware knowledge, you can actually dive into the flight control yourself and do little tweaks. Typically for drones, you get what you pay for, but this DJI Phantom is probably the most reliable for the money at this point. So a drone, let me just... drone is kind of an umbrella term for any sort of unmanned aircraft system. This specifically is a quadcopter, so it has four propellers that provide all of the torque and all of the movement. And so if you were flying a plane, typically you're always going forward and you kind of have to bank left or right. But with this, you can stay still in 3D space and the drone is always going to be level. So it might tilt just a little bit if I'm trying to bank right or left, but it's always going to be relatively level. And you get less flight time out of that, but you get steadier shots out of that. And you can be more precise with how you film when you use a quadcopter.
Since we're supposed to repeat the question, that one was what's the difference between a drone and another model aircraft, another radio-controlled aircraft. And, Amelia, I'm going to ask you to take over because we have more questions but little time.
Great. Do you want to try one last question about the drone? You can do that.
We'll be here.
Question is, has he tried running multiple drones at one time and having them network with each other?
So for our uses in news gathering, there's really not a lot of benefit for that. Typically, it's one drone and one controller using one camera. You might have seen footage from MIT, their engineering department, who's experimented with creating drones that kind of fly in sync and can perform tasks like bouncing a ball from one drone to another. We are early enough in our program that, I mean, one drone is enough for us, just one camera. But, I mean, feasibly, yes, if you had some sort of software that could coordinate multiple drones, you could get multiple camera angles. Or fly one drone with a camera and one drone with another instrument, perhaps. Maybe if you wanted to get atmospheric data or temperature data. So there is a use, and it is possible, but we haven't gotten that far yet.
Okay, thank you very much, both of you guys. And so now, if you want to hit the connection here, we'll move on to the gaming part of the morning. So we have a, we're using that when I'm up here. Okay. So we have a wonderful panel of very knowledgeable and interesting people for you to talk about the connections that I see very clearly between gaming and journalism. And before I introduce them very briefly, just a few facts to sort of whet your interest and explain a little bit about how I made the transition from being a newspaper reporter covering the environment and local news and many other things to somebody who is now in a doctoral program at Michigan State University beginning to study educational technology and game design and why I see a connection there. A moment about my path since I think I know many of you, and it seems strange. Obviously, newspapers are in deep financial trouble. They are at a loss as to how to make money and be able to pay their staffs. At this time, about 4 years ago, I decided that I wanted to go back to school and get some more different education that was going to be more technology-oriented. And I got a master's degree from the University of Michigan School of Information, where I was studying things like human-computer interaction and digital preservation of information online and game design. And I was just fascinated with those courses in game design and decided that that at the same time that traditional legacy media companies were losing a lot of their audience as it was becoming more fractured, games were increasing exponentially as an entertainment and information kind of delivery, learning medium. And just as in the news business, we have many different kinds of news, some that are more popular, that involve celebrities perhaps, and some that are less popular, that involve information in the public interest. There's the same kind of division in the gaming industry. There are games like Grand Theft Auto 5, which was just released a couple of weeks ago, and I have some statistics here. It had, within 24 hours of its release, it generated more than $800 million in revenue, exceeding the previous first-day sales record of $500 million by Call of Duty Black Ops 2. 3 days after the release of this game, Grand Theft Auto 5, the game had surpassed $1 billion in sales, making it the fastest-selling entertainment product, including games or films, in all history. So while this was happening, so while there is this side of the gaming industry, there is another side that is focused on games for change, games in the public interest, games for learning, and I think that side of the industry has a lot of connections with, potential connections with journalism. Just to give you some sense of how big gaming is in our society, the U.S. is the biggest gaming market in the world. 69% of the head of households in the United States say that they play computer or video games. 97% of youth play computer or video games. 40% of all gamers are women. 1 in 4 gamers is over the age of 50. The average gamer is 35 and has been playing for 12 years. And most gamers expect to play for the rest of their lives. This is according to the Entertainment Software Association's annual study of game players. And so it's an everyday part of life, an increasing part of life, and it's an increasingly important delivery mechanism and collection mechanism for information. One more statistic, 61% of CEOs, CFOs, and top executives reported taking gaming breaks at work in a 2009 study published by the Journal of Cyberpsychology, Behavior, and Social Networking. So this is a phenomenon that we want to pay attention to and connect with. Our panelists here, I have posted their bios, or Cindy, I've given Cindy their bios, and she has posted them on the conference website. So I won't read them for you again, but just very briefly say that we have Jane G, who is a longtime game developer from Toronto with her own, and an entrepreneur with her own company called Springboard. And
Spring Bay.
And she, the details are in the conference site, on the conference site. And she made the transition from more popular oriented games to focusing exclusively on building games related to environment issues. Kind of like a longer term project that a journalist might work on. And then via the Google, the Google Hangout here, we have Ben Shapiro, who's on screen now from Tufts University in Boston. And Ben is intimately involved with some of the most famous games that are related to the environment. And he just moved from the University of Wisconsin, which has a very big and well-known games and society learning project. And his colleague, Steve Wangen, Professor Steve Wangen from the University of Wisconsin, also is joining us. Steve is a scientist who wants to help popularize information about science through games. And we'll say a little bit more in a few minutes. And Steve is going to lead us all as we demo one of the games that Steve and Ben have developed in a few minutes. Jane is going to be up first and give us some information about her business and her ideas on games.
Thank you so much, Emilia, for your kind instruction. My name is Jane G. I'm the co-founder and game designer for Spring Bay Studio. It's such a pleasure to be here, and I'd like to share some of my thoughts on how the journalist and the game designer can work together, and also like to demonstrate some of the game we developed. So let me start with perhaps the presentation. We need your help a little bit. Not so familiar with Mac.
Okay.
If you could kind of launch
right
it. Awesome.
Yeah, and then you want to go for this.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, just a few words about what we do. We educate general public about environmental challenges through games. And we actually develop a few different type of games to serve different kind of purposes. And first of all, we call the small or mini games, which is more applicable for campaigns or petitions. Actually, our first game is developed to support one of the famous 2012 Canadian environmental campaign called the Blackout Speak Out. Hopefully, I will show that, you know, short after this. And also, we develop small games that highlight the challenges that we're facing today. One of them is called Balance. In this game, we encourage players to reach the harmony of civilization improvement, nature, and the human race, and try to find out whether there's a possible best civilization path for the mankind, which I will show after this presentation. And another for educational games we developed for the kids areas. One of our game has been selected by the Earth Day Canada to be one of their Eco Kids program. And we're currently developing a kids educational game on biodiversity for the tablet platform. And for the mobile side, actually, we notice a lot of interesting apps that encourage people to take action. And personally, I am very interested in this project, in this area, and we're working with a local environmental group to produce one of the mobile game that could help people reconnect with nature. So probably I have to, I find some games currently is dealing with the environmental challenges and also mobile apps. This is a kind of a not exclusive list. I would encourage you to play them and get a sense of how game can do or apps can do for environmental challenges. And perhaps I won't have the time to go through some of them, but I will highlight my point here. I basically group them into three categories based on the purpose they serve. And the first is raise the awareness and also the environmental challenges. One of them, for example, called the Climate Challenge. This is hosted on the BBC's website. And this game, the player presumed the role of the president of the European nation. And he has to tackle the climate challenge and also stay popular with the voters so he will remain in office, otherwise the game will be over. So this touch upon a lot of the aspect of the environmental issues such as politics, economics, urban planning and population, for example. The second, which we see a lot, is the education. One of the app I would like to highlight is called the Wild Lab Bird. In this app, you can collect and share the scientific data about birds and other wild animals as the what we call the citizen scientists. Very interesting. And for talking about the mobile applications, I did not find any game specific for this area, but I do see quite a few good apps. For example, Commit to Act. This is an iPhone app. As you see the list here, those are the commitment the players can sign on, which they think align with the things matter to them, and keep tracking their improvement, their progress on that, and they can get inspired by the community generated around this app. And also, they can compete with their friends and they can encourage them to play along. So that way to amplify the effect for what they're doing. I think the rest of the point perhaps I can explain when I show my game. I will just switch over to the balance game that we developed.
To the conference website for this session. It has URLs for many of the games that Jane is mentioning, so you can check those out on your own later.
This game actually is developed in, there's no audio? Sorry?
The audio should be connected there, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Is it?
All right, maybe it's not there yet. Okay, good. It's a kind of a low. Thank you. This game actually is developed on the, Global Game Jam this year. It was the concept actually come up pretty quickly, but the thought actually has been going on in my mind for a long time. As a game designer, I know the issues we're facing, and from my specialty, I would like the players that they can see them, they can experience, they can manipulate, which the game as a powerful media can allow the people to do. For this one, we want to present a very short web game that the players can get the point in a few minutes when they play it. The game, the goal is try to push all the six elements to the maximum. So all those six elements actually was chosen to represent the nature, our civilization improvement, and also human being. For example, I will just go through them as I play. This is the theme for this year's Game Jam. So we have a heartbeat and also a globe. And the icon here represents for this one is the energy, and this is the technology. This is the forestry and also the natural habitat, and this is the water. And for this one, this is factoring or manufacturing industry, and this represent ourselves, our human being. So in order to push all the if you see here over on the top left, there will be six elements. Your goal is try to push them to their maximum. So how can you do that? You have to start, you know, you can either just click on them and then see the effect right away, or you will find actually some of them have preconditions. For example, the energy I just clicked on is related with the science improvement. So in order to you to upgrade your energy, you have to improve your science first. It's kind of, that's how our past civilization did. And then as your scientists improve, you can create more advanced energy sources. For example, right now, I could develop something like the coal mine. The coal mine is a good thing for the improvement itself, but however, you will have some kind of pollutions, which are negative effects happening. And once you see that happen, you can see your natural resources, like the forest and the water, their level actually going down. So you see the connections between our what we've achieved and also what the thing happening, you know, to the nature because of our improvement. So now I increase my technology again, and then I will once I update my energy, it will take me to our current level, which is the fossil fuel age, and then. With this, actually, it can improve my manufacturing power to the modern one, which has a lot of the productions. And you will see, actually, the population growth, because that's what happened. We create a lot of cool things, and we can make a lot of, convenient for ourselves. And we also, make the population grow to current stage. But also, at the same time, this icon for human, they represent actually both, there are two meanings. One is population. Another is how well, how healthy we are, how happy we are. So it's kind of like try to serve two goals. Although the population, you saw they grow at the first place, but because of the because of the pollution caused by our activity, so their happiness draw down. So you have to balance each one of them. I guess to be short, the best is, you know, we increase our science, our understanding for the nature around us, our behavior, and then we can figure out, you know, the best technology, the best technology for the energy that we're depending on. For now is the sustainable energy, and based on that, we can improve our production to reduce our pollution level, and therefore, you know, we could make people more happier.
We got it. Yeah.
Okay, sure. And so from here, you can try to achieve everything, you know, because we remove the pollution, it's possible to make everything go to the maximum. I probably don't have the time to finish the entire game, but you see the point. In a short period of time, a game can predict, can give a very vivid depict of what happening around all the elements for the environmental issues. That will be all.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. First, let's go. Thank you, Jane. Let's now go to... to Ben. Ben. Hi.
Hey, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Great. Okay, one sec. Let's see. First time I've done a talk this way. Okay, can you guys see that?
Yes. Nice.
Great. All right. So, I'm not a journalist, but I have some thoughts about where you all might go and some of your work, and I thought I'd share them with you. In particular, I'm excited because I think where I think you guys could go has a lot to do with where I'd like to go in collaboration with you. So I'm an assistant professor at Tufts University, where I direct Lab for Playful Computation. I'm an assistant professor in computer science and also in education, and I work out of our Center for Engineering Education and Outreach. My contact info is at the bottom of the slide if you'd like to get in touch. And what I'd like to share are some thoughts about ways in which public discourse about science is broken and ways in which journalists, game developers, educational researchers, and scientists might work together to better inform the public. So the sort of dream model that a lot of people have is that public communication around science looks sort of like this. Scientists are making interesting discoveries. Reporters are free to report on those in ways that do justice to the science, thereby informing the public, and policymakers who are both, there should be an arrow between journalists and policymakers too, but the idea is that the public are informed, and that journalists play a key role in mediating between the general public and scientists. But as I noted, that if this is a dream, and if this dreamy model were actually in effect, we wouldn't have problems like this. We wouldn't have millions of people believing that global warming is a hoax, or even beyond environmental science, having grossly misinformed ideas about issues like stem cell biology. This is a cartoon from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette with a sort of religious right politician saying, let's pray for the sinners who engage in the devil's work of stem cell research. And then people in the audience are saying, Lord, help them find a cure for dad's Alzheimer's, and a cure for mom's Parkinson's, and a cure for my cancer, and so forth. And so while some media, I think, do a really good job of sort of fairly representing the scientific consensus, venues like the New York Times. Sorry, there's a really bad echo. It's making it hard for me to... lots of media don't do a good job of doing this justice. So outlets like Fox News that seem to draw more from the land of make-believe than science, often very much encouraged by corporate agendas, don't lead to the public being truly informed about what's happening in environmental science. And so what I think we need to think about are ways that we can restructure the discourse. And I think that that goes deeper than sort of abandoning the voice from nowhere and just sort of not reporting on people who, but instead thinking about ways to disintermediate scientists and the public. In particular, to think about ways in which journalists can act as interaction designers and facilitators of learning. So ways in which you all might work together with people like me to combine your expertise in storytelling and activism with our joint expertise in research and expertise that's emerging from the scientific community around citizen science and from the community around game design. So I'm going to focus on citizen science and game design. They were touched on already by some of the comments, but I just want to do a little bit of framing of that for you. So citizen science refers to the practice of generally scientists or conservation groups working together with the public to gather data about what's happening in neighborhoods, communities, watersheds, things like cataloging water quality. There's a nice group that does that in Pittsburgh, for example. Groups like the Audubon Society have pretty frequent bird counts where they encourage people to go out in their neighborhoods and catalog all the different bird species that they're seeing so that they can get better data on population and migration dynamics. And there are groups, the birders are amazingly active in this, but there are groups that are working to combine that with models of climate change in order to both get better data and at least educate the public who are participating in the data collection. As Amelia mentioned, there is a ton of interesting work going on games and learning. And this is, I think, very important because, as she noted, 97% of teens play games, according to recent Pew data, and the majority of adults do as well. I get asked pretty often, is that both boys and girls? And I say, yeah, it's 97% of all teenagers, all of them, boys and girls. And one of the things that research has shown over the years is that not just as sites for play, games are really powerful sites for learning. So, for example, around the game Simulation, around the game Civilization, there are huge online communities of game players who treat the game as a simulation, and they use them to do things like conduct experiments about alternative histories. So, for example,
what would have happened if the Native Americans tried to invade Europe instead of the other way around? And they discover things about, for example, the importance of horses in conquest. This is some of Kurt Squire's work, has studied this in school classrooms. And what happens is when players sort of disentangle these games by doing systematic experiments in them, they actually can develop really sophisticated models. They reverse engineer system dynamics in order to figure out how to win better. Right? So the game itself is sort of a loose model of history. It's not 100% scientifically accurate. But what happens is people who get really into the game and play start to do something that looks a lot like science, and that they're starting to figure out how the system works. And in fact, this map of influences in the game was created by high school students. When you go and study the discourse that happens in online communities around games, you start to notice that people are doing a lot of things that look like science and scientific language. So they do things like marshal evidence in order to build on each other's ideas or to make counterarguments. They offer alternative explorations of data. They reason based on models of system dynamics. They'll sometimes create mathematical models. And so these percentages are from a study of, I believe, a World of Warcraft site with millions of posts, and a surprisingly large number of them do science.
Too scary.
Now, the challenge with this sort of work is that they're studying a fantasy world that is not really connected to scientific reality. So they might be learning a lot about how a monster behaves or how to defeat a monster. What they're not learning about is how to improve the environment. And so one of the ways that I think we can do better is to think about how we can use these sorts of technologies to create motivating, playful environments that enable scientists and engineers and journalists and the public to come together to learn about science, to learn about the environment, and ultimately to imagine and construct better worlds. Now, there's already been some work to directly connect up science and games. And that work has had some really interesting implications for science, but mostly that's been the limit of it. As I'll note later, there's been a big scientific impact, but there's actually almost no research that says people who are participating in these kinds of environments, as they've currently been constructed, are learning much about science. So you've probably heard of Foldit. It's received things like Wired Stories, mentions in the New York Times, places like that. So this is a game created at University of Washington. It's a puzzle game where people work together to solve molecular biology puzzles. And it's resulted in publications in places like Nature. So it's pretty cool from a scientific perspective. Another similar site for crowdsourcing science is Galaxy Zoo, now expanded into what's called Zooniverse. And this started when a bunch of astrophysicists needed help labeling Hubble imagery. So they asked people to label, hey, is this a picture of a spiral or not? And if it is it clockwise or counterclockwise, or can't you tell? And millions of people have participated in this site, and it's led to some cool discoveries about what's out in space, as well as a ton of academic papers. I mean, this is a Google Scholar search that goes on and on and on. Which is great for the scientists, but as I noted, there's basically zero evidence that these environments are teaching users any sort of deep science, that it's actually preparing their users to participate in more knowledgeable ways in society and the world. And so that's a direction in which I think there's room for educational researchers and for journalists to start pushing on the academic scientific community to think about how they can design these environments so that they're not only scientifically productive, but also support learning. So there are examples, however, of people using interactive media technologies at a grassroots level to do some pretty powerful journalistic things. So after the Fukushima disaster in Japan, a bunch of people got together and started swapping tips online for how to build networked radiation detectors. And what they were able to do then is create real-time maps of radiation dispersal that were far more accurate and far more timely than the information that the government was reporting to the media. And I think that's a pretty powerful example of how people could work together in order to connect scientific discovery with journalism. And so one of the things that I hope you're thinking about right now is, well, how would we do this? How would we combine these technological and interaction advances with journalism? Are you guys still there? I can't see you, so I just want to make sure I haven't lost the connection.
We're here. But are you planning to wrap up pretty soon, Ben? Because we do need time for Q&A.
You guys there?
We're here. We're here. Can you hear us?
Okay.
Yeah, we're here. Cool. But we need to wrap up pretty soon, so then we have time.
And I think the way to do that is to think about how we could create partnerships between journalists, scientists, including both professionals and amateur citizen scientists, and educational researchers, where we would work together to create virtual worlds that could support reporting and that could support scientific discovery and that support education. So I know this sounds a little nebulous, maybe a bit outlandish, so I want to talk about this a little bit more. So if you think about video games and game worlds, what they often are under the hood are simulations. So they're systems where there are rules programmed in that define the interactions of different elements within the game world. Players take on roles and they have goals. And what we can think about is how can we create those game worlds such that those rule sets are actually pretty good scientific simulations? How can we create player roles where you're actually role-playing an authentic perspective of a stakeholder or an interest group out in the world? And I'll give you an example of that from some of the work Steve and I have done in a moment. And so the idea is to enable people to role-play as those stakeholders, to learn by interacting with those scientific models. So in games like Civilization and Warcraft, people learn a lot about how those game systems work. And they do so through playful experimentation with game rules. And what I want them to do is to be able to do that with game rules that are deeply grounded in the science, so that they're actually learning in deep, nuanced, mechanistic ways about how scientific systems function.
Ben, we need to wrap up.
What would be great would be then if people could take those worlds and use them as platforms for experimenting with what-ifs. So if they could experiment with, for example, what happens if my town adopted this policy, or if we did this intervention to restore an animal species, what might happen in the world? And I think that if we can think about how to do that, we can think about how gameplay can be an entree into policy analysis and into civic participation.
Ben.
And I think journalists have an essential role in making this happen.
There we go. Perfect. Ben, that's really interesting. Are you near the end? We need to make some time for Q&A.
Sure. Yeah, so let me just say one more thing.
Okay.
One is that nobody's ever done this before. There's this nice Peter Drucker quote about how the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And I think that's very much true here. This is wide open terrain, and there are many academics working in this space who would be thrilled to collaborate with you. If I had more time, I'd tell you about a project that Steve and I, along with some others, have been working on that actually implements a lot of these ideas. And I'd be happy to talk about that during questions.
Yeah, we'll have a few minutes to look at that, I believe. So let's take some questions now. Anybody have any questions for any of the speakers? And I'll repeat for the ones who are visiting us remotely. Yes, and we're hoping that, can you come forward to the mics here? Journalists, SCJ members first, please. Please tell us your name and your affiliation.
My name is Heather Duncan. I'm a freelancer, and I'm just curious about who pays for this work.
Heather Duncan, a freelancer, is curious about who pays for this work.
And I don't necessarily mean just this work specifically, but
that's a great question.
Who do you envision will be paying for this
kind of work? Currently, our work is funded by grants from NSF, which is in not a great shape right now, given the sequester and right now the shutdown. There's remarkable interest from industry as well as the financial sector in this sort of work as well. So several of my friends and I have been approached repeatedly by, for example, banks and the Federal Reserve and other financial institutions who are interested in thinking about how can we create environments like this to help people to better understand fiscal policy. I know, you know, newspapers are in pretty dire straits, but it would be really nice to think about ways in which they'd be, for example, working on grants with academics so that when we're looking to raise money to build systems like this, we can have journalists as collaborators, not just as people who eventually report on the work. You know, I don't know how that lines up with sort of journalistic ethics and all the different kinds of policies you have to operate, but it would be really interesting to explore what those possibilities are.
And one other thing I've been thinking about is the textbook market is huge in this country. Those players are trying to go digital and producing e-versions of many of their texts, but as somebody who has children who uses those textbooks, they're not interactive. Basically, most of them are PDF versions of the text.
Yeah.
And so there's a potential there to add a lot of interactivity in and perhaps switch from a text to a game. That's one idea. Jane, do you have any other thoughts on how you're funded?
Most of our games, is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. Most of our games actually is taking either from a sponsorship, which means, you know, we work with the a local environmental organizations, and they somehow get funding from some sort, and then we work together to develop the games. Well, this is probably can only apply to a small scale, but echo to what Emilia has mentioned. I noticed in the Game for Change community, there's a lot of investment in the educational, especially for the K-12 market. And I know from the environmental organizations, they all have these on the biodiversity, on the climate change, they have a lot of a lessons plan for teachers to incorporate. So I also believe that can be a very good market to start with.
Thanks. Okay, next question.
Hi, I'm Emily Gertz. I'm a freelancer based in New York. I actually have two questions. The first is for Jane, and then anyone, Ben or Steve, if they have answers as well. Is there any evidence or even sort of anecdotal evidence that games of these sorts, games like Games for Change about environmental challenges, push out beyond the sort of already bought in community? Because one of the big challenges with environmental news is that basically often the primary audiences have already made up their minds. They either kind of agree with you that there's a problem, or they want to push back against your findings that there's a problem and argue that the problem doesn't matter or that there isn't a problem.
Let me take a quick moment to, I am repeating the question for the audience and for, we're not, are we recording? I think we are. So Emily Gertz,
yes.
I need to repeat the question? No. Not when it's on the mic. Okay. Did you guys hear it?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Jane, go ahead.
Okay. I think, to be honest, I don't have the academic studies on how effective these things are. But as I mentioned, I do work with a lot of environmental groups around the Great Toronto Area. One of them is called Earth Day Canada. They run a very successful educational program in the school. It's called the Eco Kid program. In that program, they actually already selected one of our games. It's called the Garlic Spray. Try to teach kids about the organic pest control. I guess my answer to your question directly would be, yes, they are environmental groups who has the plan, and they work with school, with the school-age kids, and they know what might work. And, at least for that demographic, I think there's still hope, and there's even in their curriculum, they have the environmental...
None literacy. For the rest of us.
Yeah,
no
for, the,
for
rest
the rest
of us. Yeah, I guess, you know, when I attend the Game for Change summit this summer, I think some of the presentations mentioned about the evidence, but I need to Google it and perhaps get back to you on that. Maybe the others presenters have some data in that regard.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that. So one of the things that we've been really excited about is the ways in which games like this can help people to discuss with one another the kinds of stances and perspectives that they have. So rather than thinking about it as people on one side or the other, or people who believe there's a problem and don't, acknowledging the fact that people have these different perspectives, that the game worlds can be an opportunity for them to explore those perspectives, to try them out, to demonstrate to others, and even to be surprised about the ways in which their assumptions break down. So in a few moments, Steve is going to do a demo for you of a game that we worked together with other researchers at the University of Wisconsin on around bioenergy farming. And one of the really interesting things that's happened when we've played this with teenagers is that they start out articulating pretty strong perspectives, positions on balances between, for example, environmental health and self-development, capitalism, things like this. And then over time as they're playing, they realize some of the limitations of those perspectives. And they talk about them, they argue about them with each other, and they do move. And they move in both directions. We've had students advocate really, really strong environmental protection positions and then realize that there's no way for the farmers that they're playing as to stay solvent. And so they move a little bit towards more economically liberal stances as they play. Likewise, the players who are advocating sort of an Ayn Rand stance do start to realize some of the limitations of that perspective as well. So that's data we're still analyzing and that we're planning to submit for publication before the end of the year.
Okay, let's take, since we're running short on time because we have started late, let's have a show of hands. We have another question, or we could take a quick look at the game that Steve is willing to demo for us, and we could play with each table representing one player. Okay, Jay has a great suggestion. Those who would like to stay and take a look at the game during the next session, we can stay in here and do that. So why don't we just roll with the questions? Any other questions now? One last question? And make an announcement, and then we'll continue with the game for anybody who would like to try and have a taste of this. Go ahead, Jim.
Jim Bruggers, Courier Journal, Louisville, Kentucky. This probably would be a pretty quick question, reflecting my ignorance. So how difficult is it to program one of these games? What skill sets do you need? And are there any applications that people could buy that just so you can point and click your way and develop a very simple one?
Yes, there are ways to develop very simple ones, but these guys know them better than I do. In schools, very young children are working with these platforms to create games, not as elaborate as and beautiful as the one that Jane showed us, or as the ones that these guys will show us in a few minutes. GameStar Mechanic is one of the most famous ones. Go ahead.
No, I was thinking of GameStar. I was thinking of Game Maker, Scratch. In fact, the game that Steve's going to show you started out as a class project by some undergrads in a course that we were teaching. And then we later gave it quite a bit of polish. But depending upon the level of complexity you're looking for, it's very much doable.
Okay. Well, thank you. Ready for that announcement. And then those who want to stay, we'll move into an actual game. And people can work in teams to try and solve some of these problems. And we can do that for 10, 15, 20 minutes, as long as you want. Go ahead.
Thank you, Amelia, and all the other, Jane, and all the other speakers.